D-Mace, Finnegan, and Donick, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. And we are presented by Bet365. Whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, and Adam Vingan here with you. Vanderbilt, the number one overall seed in the NCAA baseball tournament. But I was surprised to see, gentlemen, that Vanderbilt is not the betting favorite to win the College World Series. That would belong to Arkansas. Arkansas are 9-2 favorites at ESPN Bet, followed by LSU at 6-1, and Tennessee at 8-1. Vanderbilt is at 10-1. So I saw a lot of this, and we've seen a little bit of this in the text line today. Because remember, we had the one texter who thought that Derek was praising Tim Corbin a little too much.
Yeah.
Then we had a texter come in, Scott, I believe it was, defending Tim Corbin. Then that initial texter responded to Scott. So there's a schoolyard bash, schoolyard bash happening in our text line, Tennessee and Vanderbilt baseball fans. But I found it interesting, guys, that Tennessee has higher championship odds than Vanderbilt. Tennessee is the 14th overall seed in the NCAA tournament. They are hosting a regional with Wake Forest, Cincinnati, and Miami of Ohio. So, Willie, what do you make of Tennessee having better odds of winning the title than Vanderbilt?
It surprises me a little bit just because Tennessee has struggled the way they have down the stretch of the season. They've not played their best baseball the last 5 or 6 weeks. It's not just the last couple of weeks. It's been coming on for a while.
It was an impressive win against Texas the other day, but then the Volunteers followed that up with being run ruled 10-0 by Vanderbilt.
Right, and it's not any one or two games. I think it's overall how they played, and also they are not a national seed, so in theory they will have to go on the road for the Super Regional, which is not automatic because upsets happen and suddenly they could be hosting. I've seen that happen before. So that part surprised me a little bit, but when you're the defending champ and you're as talented as Tennessee is, Tennessee's got a lot of talent. I think just from an odds maker standpoint, I don't know how it all works, but I know the reputation will probably contribute to that. What I'm not surprised about is Arkansas, because Arkansas is a very powerful team. They swept Vanderbilt at Vanderbilt before Vanderbilt really hit their stride, but nonetheless, they came into Nashville and did what really nobody has done this year at Hawkins Field, and so that really impressed me. And they have a tremendous home field advantage at Fayetteville. They've got one of the best stadiums, crowds. So part of the odds, I think, are set on who they think is going to get to Omaha. Then the matchups happen when you get there. So it's tough to predict, just like anything else.
Yeah, it is. To me, I was somewhat surprised because of how Vanderbilt has been playing. And it's not about how well you play during the season. It's about how well you are playing once the tournament starts. And Vandy is playing extremely well. I think they only gave up 3 runs in 3 games this past weekend, I believe. So it seems like they're in their groove now. And, you know, it seems like they're playing better baseball than UT or any other team out there. But we understand that this is going to continue to be a long road to the College Baseball World Series. But if we were talking about any other sport, whether it be basketball or football, at how hot this team has been, we would take Vandy and say, if this was football, we would say they are probably in the driver's seat in regards to winning a national championship or at least making it to the game, because they're playing so well at the critical time of year. But in baseball, it's not like that. Just because you're playing hot, I guess, doesn't mean too much of anything. Because when you look at Vandy, they don't have, the explosive pitching or the explosive hitting, guys hitting the ball at the ballpark. again, they have a damn good balanced team and a really good team. So when people look at that as opposed to, say, UT, and they see a little bit more firepower, they tend to say, well, I know Vandy's playing well right now. I know they only gave up three runs. I know they're a good hitting team. But if those bats start to catch hot for UT, man, whew, they can take this all the way to the championship. So I understand that part. But, man, I think Vandy's hot right now. I think their defense, their pitching is good. I think they're hitting the ball well. And I would give them just as good a shot at winning a national championship as I would, you know, UT.
I think one other thing, Adam, that might contribute to this is that Vanderbilt is probably viewed as a team that is overachieved some, an overachieving one. They weren't preseason number one. It's odd because the top two teams ranked in the preseason, one and two, didn't even make the tournament. So we know these things are hard to predict. But Vanderbilt doesn't have – let's take what they had on some of their past great rosters. They don't have projected high first-round picks like Kumar Rocker and Jack Leiter leading the rotation. They don't have a Dansby Swanson, a first overall pick, a Brian Reynolds, who you knew was going to be a high draft pick. I think if you look at some of their great teams, this team's a little different in that they are doing it more collectively. Don't get me wrong. They've got plenty of guys that are going to get drafted, but not that high-end guy. I'm not sure if that affects the odds or not. That's just a theory on my end.
So here's just a sampling of the schoolyard bash going on in the text line. So the initial texter said, again, I'm not a fan of either team, but Corbin has been getting destroyed by Vitello and the Vols for years now. Vitello has been eating his lunch and recruiting SEC standings, trips to Omaha, and overall on-the-field performance. That all stems from Corbin's failure to adapt. Sure, this year has gone Vanderbilt's way, but it's a departure from the recent norm. Scott responded, I didn't hear the dude's response. Well, now you have, Scott. But no surprise if he's still living in 1998 with the football fans. Doesn't matter what he said. Saying this year isn't a response is just dumb. And what I did love about Vanderbilt's win against Tennessee, I don't know if either of you saw what Riley Nelson of Vanderbilt said after the game, talking about, we don't like them, they don't like us. But he also said, if you're a young kid getting recruited by both of these schools, I think you know which school you should choose. I love the little pettiness in these rivalries. But I do think that Vanderbilt's success this season has led to an interesting debate between Vols fans and Commodores fans. Because look, last year we talked about earlier in the show, last year for Vanderbilt was a down year by Vanderbilt standards. And there is nothing worse than when your favorite team has a down year and your most hated rival has an outstanding season. So Vanderbilt struggles, again, compared to recent Vanderbilt teams, and Tennessee wins the national title. That's the absolute worst feeling. But it's interesting about there are Vols fans that say, well, we won the national title last year, so it doesn't matter if Vanderbilt beat us 3-1 this year and run ruled us off the field at the SEC tournament because we won the national title last year. So I do think, Willie, it's interesting. We have these conversations in all sports about, like, who has the leg up year in and year out.
Yeah, it's funny. There's the old saying, you're only as good as your last game, so that can apply to – either side of the argument, probably. You know, Tennessee's the defending champs, so last year belonged to them. I think prior to last year, I don't know that you would say that Tennessee was dominating the series. Tennessee was getting dominated by Vanderbilt for about a decade, probably more than a decade. And then Vitello has definitely taken it to another level. As far as the recruiting, I do think that's a really big element to it, because both teams want to dominate and get the best that come out of the state, particularly the mid-state, but really all across the state. Vanderbilt recruits nationally. Tennessee does as well. But there are those guys in your backyard that have been watching these two programs for a long time. I don't know this to be a fact, but I do believe the perception from what I hear is Tennessee is definitely dangling more money. I don't know about high school recruits, but certainly with the transfers. For example, Tennessee does have an incredible left-handed pitcher named Liam Doyle, who is their ace, that transferred from Ole Miss. He came across from Ole Miss. Vanderbilt has not gone into that world trying to get guys out of the portal that are coming right from another SEC school. If you look at Vanderbilt's transfers, like we talked to Mike Mancini in the first hour, they're mostly guys who were sort of overlooked at the high school level, weren't major Division I guys who have turned out to develop into that. Cody Bowker, who struck out, I think, 9 against Tennessee the other day, came from Georgetown. Fennell, who came in and finished the shutout against Tennessee, he transferred up from Dayton. Mike Mancini, James Madison, Sawyer Hawks, who we had on a couple weeks ago, Air Force. Those are the types of transfers that Tim Corbin is taking. And I would imagine, this is just me guessing, I don't know, but those guys aren't coming out there dangling, going for the highest dollar. I would imagine it's much more likely that guys like Liam Doyle, who are going from one big end program like Ole Miss to another, are getting rewarded financially for that. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what's happening all across college sports. But I think that is an ingredient to the rivalry, where I keep going back to one thing that is great for any rivalry. You got two programs that could not go about it more differently in so many respects. And so that makes for a great rivalry, especially when both teams win a lot.
I think that's what's fueling this, is the way, and I'm not saying the way UT is going about it is wrong, because it's not. It's just the way they choose to go about it. They are a little bit more boisterous. They are a little bit more in your face. You know, they know they got a good team, and they want you to know it. They want everybody to know it. They're not ashamed to be that type of team. Whereas the other hand, Corbin is just like, let's just get our work done, man. That's what we're about. We're not about all that. We'll celebrate if we win. But we go about it doing it our way, and it works. And UT goes about it doing their way, and it works. But here is the question. When I thought about it, I didn't want to ask it, because I don't want to seem like as if I'm taking sides, because I think, you know, Coach, you know, Tony has a Vitello has a good pro. He's got that program, and it's going, and it's good. And I think Coach Corbin, what he's been able to do, speaks for itself. If you are, and this is just a question, if you are a player, and because some coaches, I think, or some programs, they got to go get that guy that's already established, where some programs can go get that guy and develop that guy into what he's going to be. If you had a choice, and I'm not going to sit here and say either choice is wrong, you take it. Which one would you choose? Corbin or Tony Vitello in that program? Which one would you choose? It's just a question, because that's, to me, that's fundamentally what it's about. You know, one, yeah, money. You want the money. I understand that. But if the money was equal, which program would you choose? Which head coach would you choose? I would dare to say, and I'm going out on a limb here, I may be going out, I would think people would look at Coach Corbin and be like, I'd take Coach Corbin. Nothing wrong with Tony at all. But if you're just looking at the history, what's been done, you may lean to Coach Corbin before you lean to Tony. Not to say what Tony's doing with his program isn't good, because it is. They won a national championship. Can't scoff at that. But I think Corbin is about, and he makes no qualms, I'm about developing. And I'm not saying Tony's not, but I'm about developing. And if I can stick to that premise, then my team's going to be all right. I do need to bring those other guys in here and there, but if I stick to my core of developing a player, even those guys that I bring from Air Force or this school, if they still have some development in them, I'm going to develop them to a better player than what they are now. Not to say that Tony doesn't do that, but if you're looking at the big picture, which one would you take? That's all.
I don't know. Oh, go ahead, Willie.
Well, the only thing I would add, too, mm-hmm. is we've talked about how Tim Corbin has adapted mm-hmm. to the new world of college sports. I think every coach, and this is where I think still Tim Corbin has separated himself from just about every coach going, is he's done it for so long. So he's had to adjust a lot of times, right? Going back to the early 2000s, he had to build it where they hadn't had a lot of success. Then he had to sustain it. He was getting courted by all kinds of other programs that wanted to pluck him. And traditionally, Vanderbilt had lost coaches like him on the rise. They lost James Franklin. Going back, they lost Eddie Fogler. But Tim Corbin stuck it out, right? Then he had to learn how to sustain it. So every coach, regardless of NIL, has got to adapt and adjust to do it for as long as he's done it. And I think that's going to be the next step for Tony Vitello, is he's done it his way. He's made a huge impact in a fairly short period of time. Mm-hmm. Now to sustain it year in and year out, he's probably going to have to adjust because everybody yeah. else is now hip to how he does it. It's not new anymore how they play. Other teams are now getting in and learning how to use NIL to the best of their advantage. And so he's got to adjust accordingly to sustain. That's the challenge. That's what we love about competition.
The Commodores.
But he's got a long way to go before he gets put in the class. Yeah, you get it. You definitely give him the round last year, and they've had some great teams leading up to finally winning it mm-hmm. last year. But Vanderbilt's standard has been that for, you know, 10 or 15 years.
615-737-1025. The Commodores will open the College World Series against Wright State at Hawkins Field on Friday at 5 o'clock. 615-737-1025. Coming up next, Derek and I were having an interesting conversation at the beginning of Friday's program, and Jared texted me a question that I found to be quite insightful, and I wanted to wait until Willie came back, because Willie was out on Friday. I wanted to wait until Willie came back to discuss it. So we'll do that next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025-1063, The Game. D. Mace, Vingan, and Donick, 1025-1063, The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan here with you. The Stanley Cup playoffs roll on tonight. Game 4 between the Edmonton Oilers and Dallas Stars. Edmonton, a 6-1 win against Dallas a couple of nights ago. But Willie, on Friday, you were out, and Derek and I started the show talking about the world of sports. The night before, the Florida Panthers defeated the Carolina Hurricanes 5-0. And Derek and I were talking about how, as I've been watching these Stanley Cup playoffs, and I've said this a couple of times, it feels like the teams that are left in the Stanley Cup playoffs are playing a different sport than the Predators played this past season. The Panthers, the Hurricanes, the Oilers, the Stars, they are on another level. And as we were discussing that, Jared texted me an interesting question, because he was hearing what I was saying about the Florida Panthers and how you know what you're getting when you play against the Florida Panthers. They have I do believe that a key ingredient to knowing if your team is a good team is you can just ask, hey, what kind of style of play does this team play? And you get a simple answer. The Florida Panthers, they're a straight-ahead team. They forecheck their butts off. They create turnovers. They wreak havoc in the defensive zone, and they take advantage of those turnovers. I likened it to fast break points in basketball. And Jared's question to me was, what should the Predators do to try to bridge the gap? Because I do think that is an important question. The Predators seem light years away from being as competitive as the teams that are still alive in the Stanley Cup playoffs. So I wanted to save this topic for you because I knew you were going to be out on Friday. So let me ask you the question that Jared asked me. What should the Predators do to try to bridge the gap and get closer to competitiveness?
I think in a word, defend. Defend better. The identity, and light years, I think, is an exaggeration. I don't think they're that far. In a salary cap sport, you're never as far as you think you are, and you're never as good as you think you are. I think they kind of learned that lesson this year, that I think they thought they were better than they were. But I think when there's a fluctuation in a lot of teams. I'll take Washington as an example. I don't think anybody thought they were going to be threatening to win the President's Trophy, but they nearly did, and they won the number one seed in the East. But I think that's a team that just had a great buy-in and had a great season. I think if the Predators have a great buy-in and a great season next year, they can be a lot better than they were. But that being said, for that to happen, I look back at Andrew Burnett's first team, and I saw a team that absolutely had the buy-in and played the system to a T, to a man. They really played it well, and they probably overachieved. Last year, I didn't see that. They weren't even close to that. They were on different pages. They were not able to play the system that Andrew Burnett wanted to play. They got into a funk. They tried to tinker under the hood, and you know, making the reference, the Indy 500 was last week. They got in the pits, you know, in the pits, and they weren't able to make the right adjustments quick enough to the engine, and they got way behind, and they were out of the race. But in a word, they didn't defend well enough. And I think if they could get better team defense, they'll make a big, big jump in bridging the gap. And you notice I say team defense. I don't even mention UC Soros in that, because the UC Soros part of it will take care of itself. If they're more predictable and they play a good team defensive game, UC Soros will do his thing at that point. They wore out UC Soros last year because they could not defend in front of him. They beat him down mentally. He held it for about 3 months and propped them up, and then sort of collapsed for a while. And the season at that point was kind of lost for everybody.
Another thing about the Panthers specifically is how that team was built. They found the exact players they need to play the game they want to play. We talked about the Predators this season and the system and the adjustments, and is Steven Stamkos a fit for what Andrew Burnett wants to do? Things of that nature. We had plenty of those conversations over the course of the regular season. I look at the Florida Panthers, and they are a team that has been expertly built by finding the players who fit that mold. The change in the Panthers' DNA was the summer that they let go of Burnett, brought in Paul Maurice, and traded for Matthew Tkachuk. That changed the DNA of that franchise. They bring in a player also from the Calgary Flames, Sam Bennett, who is a tough customer. He is a habitual line stepper, right? They have players that, you know, Gustav Forsling, who is their top pairing defenseman, was a waiver claim. Arguably the greatest waiver claim in the history of the NHL. Look who they acquired at the trade deadline this season. Brad Marchand. Perfect. He's a perfect fit for what the Florida Panthers want to do. So Barry Trotz has said that he is not going to go wild in free agency this summer. He's talked about making hockey trades. And it is imperative that Brunette and Trotz get together. They decide exactly the way they want to play, and they target players who can play that to a T. Because that's what we've seen from the Florida Panthers. They bring in the players who fit what they want to do, and it feels almost instantaneously they click. Brad Marchand was coming off of an injury when he was acquired by the Bruins. He gets plopped into that lineup. He's been outstanding in the playoffs. And they've made some other savvy moves, trading for Seth Jones, which they needed to do with, I think, Matthew Tkachuk on long-term injured reserve. They played that card. But I think that what the Panthers have done is a masterclass in roster building. And I'm hopeful that Barry Trotz, as he tries to put this team together, Willie, this summer, looks for players who can fit what Andrew Burnett wants to do, because we asked too many questions last season about whether the players they brought in, or even the players they had, were the right fit for Andrew Burnett.
Right, and now they have to decide what is the way they want to play, because the way that Andrew Burnett wants to play, or wanted to play last year, I think it's pretty clear that they're not going to be able to do that next year. He's going to have to reinvent a system that is better suited for this group of players. And it's ironic that we're bringing up Andrew Burnett, because we're talking about a 5 or 6 year deal to get the Panthers to where they are now. You know, they were awful for decades until about 5 or 6 years ago. And Andrew Burnett on the staff of Florida, I think, was instrumental. And of course, we know he took over. They won the President's Trophy when they replaced him. They lost to a great team in Tampa Bay. That's the only reason that he's not still the coach of the Panthers. But they made the tweak to Maurice, and they made some good tweaks to the roster. They've had some really unique moves, as you referenced a couple, like Forsling on a waiver pickup. I mean, that's a brilliant move, but it's also a little lucky. I don't think anybody in the league thought that he was going to be that type of player. He had some underachieving guys, a lot of which played for the Buffalo Sabres, that have become completely different and better players and reached their potential with the Panthers. And when they pick really low for a long, long time, they've got a couple of guys that they got right at the very, very top of the draft with Barkov, Ekblad, and some guys like that. So it's a unique mix of what they have. I don't think you can imitate the Panthers. I think you have to be the best version of yourself. And I think it starts from the defensive zone out is where they've got to fix the most.
One texter says Bill Zito, who is the GM of the Florida Panthers, is way ahead of Trotz in general managing. That's a huge difference. He makes smart, bold trades. Trotz loses Fabro on waivers. Very general and elementary example. But I just think Trotz is way over his skis compared to the GMs of the Final Four teams. He's not even close.
I think Barry Trotz is at a crossroads here. And I think we're going to learn what kind of GM he's going to be in the next couple of years, because for the first time last year, he hit a lot of things that didn't work. I think you wouldn't have said that about him. And I'm not comparing him to Zito, because Zito's done a really nice job, bringing out a dormant franchise that couldn't draw flies about 6 or 7 years ago. I mean, Adam, you remember those days. That was one of the least populated anonymous franchises that had absolutely nothing going for it until a few years ago, and Andrew Burnett was a big part of their success as they got off the ground for sure. But I will grant you that Barry Trotz he's now got some very, very difficult decisions to make as he builds the roster for next year.
And I'm looking at the Dallas Stars too, and Predators fans are familiar with the Dallas Stars, of course, because they're in the Central Division. And you look at the roster building that they've done as well, and they made the mega trade at the deadline to get Mikko Rantanen from the Carolina Hurricanes, and they gave up a boatload to get him. They gave up a conditional first-round pick in 2026, a conditional first-round pick in 2028, a third-round pick in 2026, a third-round pick in 2027, and a really good young forward by the name of Logan Stankoven, who is 22 years old and making an impact for the Hurricanes in the Eastern Conference Final. By the way, congratulations to the Hurricanes for avoiding being swept out of the Conference Final for the fourth time in a row, which would have happened had
Stankoven. Stankoven had a big hand in why they were able to hang in there for another game.
And the reason why the Stars are comfortable trading multiple first-round picks, multiple third-round picks, a young 22, really good player in Stankoven, is because they've done an outstanding job drafting in the late first round, early second round. So they can give up those first-round picks because they've done a great job finding Jason Robertson, right, for example, in the second round. And they have a young core. They have Robertson. They have Thomas Harley. They have, I'm trying to think of who else off the top of my head, you know, Jake Ottinger, right? They have these players who are in their early to mid-20s who are stars, no pun intended. So they can give up the farm, so to speak, to trade for a superstar because they've done an excellent job drafting.
Yeah,
so,
they're in the window. They are able to go for it. Much like when David Poile had those the best Predator teams, 2016, 17, 18, 19, he was in that mode. He was trying to add that last piece, right? He was trading for Turris. He was trading for, you know, he's bringing on a veteran like Nick Bonino. He was trading for Ryan Hartman. They were in that mode. Right now, what they've been building for the last 3 or 4 years, they have not traded their first round picks. They have acquired a lot of draft picks that they've used some, and they still haven't used a lot of them. They've got the 3 first round picks, but that's the other big element of this, Adam. For them to get back, they need a wave of contributions from some of the guys in this pool of prospects that they have. It doesn't have to be one guy, it doesn't have to be 10 guys, but you just see, for example, the impact of one or two guys, how that can help you. You know, Thomas Harley coming out and doing what he's done for Dallas is another feather in their cap. I'm trying to think of some other examples of
Wyatt Johnston is an obvious one that I obviously missed.
Right. For Dallas, but other guys. Just if you get that guy, I think Toronto, as much as they've traded assets to try to get veteran players, guys like a Matthew Nyes have been gold for them. Right, a guy that they hung on to, and he's been a really good player. Nashville hasn't really had that in a while. They've got a lot of NHL players, but they need a couple to move the needle, right? They need Luke Evangelista to move the needle. He didn't last year. He's a nice player who I think could go either way this coming year. Could he turn into a player that moves the needle? Yeah, he could. But could he also end up being another guy that, okay, good, solid NHL player, but not a guy that is going to make a big impact? I think he could go that way too. And there's a bunch of other guys you can say that about. You can go right down the line at center, like with Svechkov and David Edstrom, who's a little younger. It's going to take longer to find out about him. But in the big picture, you need some of these guys to come up and help in a big way.
615-737-1025. We'll take your thoughts on where the Predators sit as we watch the conference finals in the Stanley Cup playoffs. But coming up next, our friend Jared Stillman will join us as we transition from our show to his. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025, 1063, the game. D-Mace Vingan and Donick, 1025, 1063, the game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan here with you. Stillman and company coming up next and joining us as he does at the end of our show, the one and only Jared Stillman. And Jared, before you logged on, I was looking outside the window here at our Game Nashville studios, and I squinted really hard, and I think I saw a pig fly. Because you admitted you were wrong about something. I'm proud of you. This is growth. You said on Twitter the other day that Tim Corbin had proven the doubters, including you, wrong. I now open the mic for your apology to Tim Corbin.
You know, I think it's funny. I was thinking about this, you know, a year ago today, you know, or a year ago today, Vanderbilt was going out to the Clemson regional and they ended up getting beat, I think, by High Point and some other Scarbini school.
Coastal Carolina.
Yeah. And it looked like it was.
Carolina is a really good program, but the Vanderbilt's standards are higher than losing to those two programs for sure.
I felt like it was over. I felt like the game had changed. I felt like an old dog. Couldn't learn new tricks. And, I mean, it would almost be like the change that we've seen with Vandy baseball in the last year and the way that Tim Corbin's done things that Tim Corbin probably didn't want to do. I don't think he wanted to fire Mike Baxter, who played for him as a hitting coach last year, but he did. And to see how that has translated into Vanderbilt's success, that would be like if the Titans made the playoffs next year. And we were sitting here talking about, man, the Titans, Brian Callahan's a good coach, and they've got a franchise quarterback. From where they've come, you know, Vanderbilt was so far down and Tennessee was so hot at the time. And it just tells you how much can change in a short period of time. And the other thing is, once they throw the first pitch on Friday for both Tennessee and Vanderbilt, nothing that has happened over the last couple of weeks matters at that point. But I'm so impressed with Vanderbilt. They play the game so well. I mean, there was a bunt in the Oklahoma game by Mike Mancini that I'm like, it was the most perfect bunt at the most perfect time. They run the bases well. They play defense. They pitch well in big moments. They can hit with power. They can hit like they did against Tennessee, where it's single to single and putting runs together and taking advantage of UT's mistakes. It is a fabulous team, and I am shocked by the 180 Vandy baseball's done in the last year.
So we should have told Mancini that when we had him on the program. Jared Stillman said you laid down a perfect bunt. Your thoughts. We should have done that, but we did not. But I know that your beloved Cardinals are also in the Nashville Regional. How are you feeling about that?
Well, I would say this. Like, I'm sure Willie's a little nervous about the Regional because, you know, it was funny a couple years ago. Tennessee fans, and I'm lumping a bunch of Tennessee fans into one group here. Like, I think, you know, I'm going to be completely transparent with that. That I'm lumping them in here all together as one group and everything else. But when the Tennessee fans, they didn't know baseball a couple years ago when they had the number one team in the country, and they were shocked when they lost to Notre Dame in that Super Regional. I said, look, it's hard to win in this tournament. And Vanderbilt fans were loving the fact that Tennessee had that dream season and didn't even make it to Omaha. And I said, they know exactly what this is like because they went through that in 2007. And so I think, you know, everybody here now recognizes how difficult it is to win in this tournament. I've seen Vanderbilt with a team that wasn't its best team go into Louisville and beat Louisville's best team in a regional. I've seen Louisville without their best team come here in the Supers in 2013 and knock out the number two team in the country. So I would not say that, you know, people should feel comfortable. That being said, Louisville's pitching is a disaster right now, and I would be stunned the way Vanderbilt's playing if they didn't really three-game sweep this thing into the Super Regionals.
That's a good quick history, Jared, of Vanderbilt and Louisville, because it does date back to, what was the first year, 2008, I think, or 2009, the first time they played in a regional?
I want to say it was 2009, and it was went to a Monday, and Mike Minor came back on short rest. He actually got lit up by MTSU in the first game, and Vandy came all the way back out of the loser's bracket to force a Monday night game, and Mike Minor made his final appearance and got lit up in that one, and Louisville went on. And then the next year, Louisville had a 50-win team that was a national seed. Vanderbilt, not that great, went to Louisville, lost with Sonny Gray in the second game, and then came back and won on a Monday night. So there has been a lot of history. They've played in Omaha multiple times. These are two programs that don't like each other. It's not as, you know, as tenuous as Vanderbilt, Tennessee is at this point, but these are two programs that do not like each other.
I agree. I think 2013 was a great one that you mentioned too, Jared. I think the 2013 team was probably arguably better than the 2014 team that won the whole thing, because they had Mike Yastrzemski and they had Tony Kemp, and they had some really good pitchers, and they lost two in a row to Louisville. So anything can happen. I do think that is something you got to be careful in baseball, probably more than any other sport, with maybe the exception of hockey. The randomness of what can happen in a short period of time. The best team doesn't always win. I think, if I remember correctly, Jared, that at least once, if not both, of the national championships that Vanderbilt won, the number one overall seed got beat. I think it was UCLA most recently. Mm-hmm. So you're never safe. So the one overall seed, and they learned the lesson right there in 2007, because they didn't get out of the regional. They lost to Michigan that year, who was not a great team. But it's baseball.
What I think is crazy about kind of this, the way that this is, that in 2007, and I was a big Vanderbilt fan, that was a team that everybody, you know, in town was paying attention to, with David Price and Pedro Alvarez and Dominic De La Osa. And I didn't feel like that team could lose, especially in the regional. I didn't think that team could lose. And they got knocked out on the Monday night game against Michigan. And I was stunned at the time. You know, I was 18, 17 years old. And then I saw all the Tennessee fans and how stunned they were a couple years ago, that now I do feel like everybody's kind of in the same place, where everybody kind of now recognizes, like, yeah, we all get how college baseball works and how difficult it can be. And teams can be down to their final strike and can come out of a regional and end up in Omaha. So I think everybody now understands. Like, I don't look at Vanderbilt and say, oh, okay, they're for sure going to Omaha. They should win the national title just because they're the one seed. I don't feel that way, because I know how uneven, you know, how uneven this sport is and this tournament is. And let's not forget, like, Kentucky's not great. Mm-hmm. And Vanderbilt played them and had to win on walk-off homers in consecutive nights. So every time it's a war out there. And I think Vanderbilt understands it. And I think their fans understand it as well, because they've been through it so much.
How did you feel about James Franklin being in the Vanderbilt dugout at the SEC
title game? Holy crap, what a freaking clown show. What a freaking clown show. I actually had it in my notes. I wrote down, can't have James Franklin in the dugout. Like, I thought that was so embarrassing. I think it's embarrassing to Franklin. I think it's embarrassing to Vanderbilt. I think it's, like, look, you want to be friends with Tim Corbin? Be friends with Tim Corbin. In the dugout?
Willie, how do you feel about it? Willie, how do you feel about it?
I think I was a little surprised to see him in the dugout. I actually went to the College World Series in 2014, and I happened to be sitting right next to James Franklin. He was in the stands, even though he had already left Vanderbilt. He had coached a year at Penn State. I think if you look closely, you will see Tim Corbin on the sideline at Penn State football games. So it's a reciprocal thing. It's both sides. They've just had that bond.
What's wrong with it, though? There's nothing wrong with it.
Well,
At all.
James Franklin left Vandy high and dry.
But there's nothing wrong with it. If he has the friendship with Coach Corbin, then there's nothing wrong with it. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with it. Vandy hadn't said anything. So, again, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just new.
They've been doing this for a long time. This isn't new. They go to each other's games a lot. And like I said, Tim Corbin numerous times has been on the sideline. It's just easier to get lost on a sideline where you got 150 people. Mm-hmm. They're in a dugout, you stand out a little bit more, right? And you're like, wait, that's the Penn State football coach. So it is unique for sure. But is there anything wrong with it? No, I don't think either one of those guys care what people think. They've been doing this for
I can promise you James Franklin cares about what people think. If he's going to go around and start chirping fans at the spring game and getting them thrown out, I think James Franklin cares what people think.
Well, obviously,
he cares what people think, but he's still in the dugout. Does that stop him from doing it?
Exactly.
Yeah. I thought that was such a clown show move. I mean, when are we going to have Butch Jones in the dugout with Tony Vitello because they were buddies and they were – I mean, at some point, like the way James Franklin left Vanderbilt, and I know maybe it's, you know, water under the bridge at this point, but between the way he left it and what had gone on at the end of his tenure, he was not a liked guy on his way out the door here. And I think that Tim Corbin should show some respect, you know, to Vanderbilt and say, you know, hey, like, you know, I love you, but we can't have you in the dugout during the SEC tournament. You know, we can't have that.
Again, you're making a big deal about nothing. I mean, if Coach
Corbin,
I'm not
making a big deal about it. Adam asked me what I thought. I think it's embarrassing. I think it's a disgrace.
How?
I think he should kick his ass out of there.
Who? Why? Why?
He should go be in the Penn State dugout.
If they were in a championship game, he probably would have been.
Oh. Well, then that just means he's an opportunist.
No, it's just
tracks with his tenure at Vanderbilt.
It means that if I'm not in it, then I'm going to go to my good friend and support him. And if he allows me to be in a dugout, then I'm going to be in a dugout. Why do we have this outrage for nothing?
Well,
again, it's not outrage, and it's not for nothing.
It is for nothing.
Speaking of outrage for nothing, Stoneman and Company is coming up next. We'll be back at 11 o'clock tomorrow.
Be love, love on your people. I love you, Jared. Be love on your people. Have a safe, blessed, wonderful Tuesday. Peace.